All right. Hi, everybody. We're back. Same day. It's RCFB Talk 64. We're going to be talking about HBCU football with the founder of HBCU Game Day, Stephen J. Gaither. He's going to be joining us in a moment. And we want to hear from you as well. This is going to be a great opportunity. Stephen's been fine about that. He wants to listen to you as well. I know there's a lot of passionate fans, not only of historically black college and university football, but also just HBCU Game Day. It's a great site. We've been fans of it for a couple of years now. Actually, more than that. I mean, a couple of years ago, it was the beginning of the pandemic at this point. Like, we've been fans a while. So I see he's here. I'm going to invite him up, and we're going to have a nice chat. So I can see he's up here. Steven, are you with us?
Hey, yes, I am. How you doing tonight?
We're doing good. How are
Doing
you?
great, doing great. No complaints. You know, it's game week. It's hectic. It's getting back to the grind. So, happy to be here.
I'm glad you were able to take some time to speak with us. I mean, this is something I've really wanted a host to have on and just to talk about things because I love the site. I mean, I remember when I first noticed it on Twitter, and then I went to the site itself, and you guys do so much great work. For those who aren't familiar with it, what is the site HBCU Game Day?
Yeah, so well, first off, thanks for the kind words. So HBCUGameDay.com started it back in 2012, and so it's 10 years this year. I mean, I guess if you take away the 2020 football season, which we didn't really have, and you don't count the spring 2021 season, this is kind of our 10th year of coverage of HBCUs. So again, just a place where folks can find out about what's going on at HBCU sports. HBCU sports in general, but basketball, football mainly, and basketball as well take up the majority of our time. So we're a collection of, journalists, also different storytellers as well that come together and just kind of make sure that we keep up to date with what's going on with HBCU sports across all levels, not only the MEAC and the SWAC, but also in the Division II ranks, the SIAC and the CIAA, as well as our NAIA and the folks that are kind of in different conferences now, as we've had some programs spread out. So, we're just a place where you can go and learn about HBCU sports and culture, what's going on. We also, in addition to focusing on what's going on, we try to give, historical context and things like that, because a lot of information isn't necessarily readily out there, or if it is, it's only surface level. And as much as we can, we try like to get dig a little bit deeper and try to give the full picture. So, long story short, I guess I'd say what that was, if that was short at all.
Well, I mean, what led you to start the website? Because as you said, it started back in 2012. It's been here for a while. It's, gosh, yeah, it is. Hey, happy 10 years. Actually, it's 11 now. But what led you to start the site?
Well, I think for me, so I went to an HBCU. I went to Winston-Salem State University,
Rams.
and yeah, your Rams. And so, when I was there, I wanted to go to school and work for the Four Letter Network after I graduated. And so that was kind of my goal. And then, the recession happened and life happened. And, trying to figure out where I fit in this journalism spectrum and, really deciding I wanted to make an impact, besides, instead of just chasing money, because, for most folks, chasing money in journalism is pretty futile. So I just kind of wanted to pursue passion. When I was at school at Winston-Salem State, we had a beat writer at the local newspaper, John Dell, who's still there. Actually, he's been, covering the same beat for 26 years now. That was just normal for us to have media there and to have him there and have coverage. But after I got out of school and just trying to keep up, with Winston-Salem State, I was able to do that, but not being able to really have an idea too much of the other schools that were in the league. The only places I could really go to get that type of information were places. There were a couple of online sites, Onnedan, which is started by Eric Moore back in the 90s, which is, they have done, original reporting, kind of keeping everybody up to date to the news and notes. And so the nuts and bolts are there. And then they also have a fan forum where people can come in and share. And I just saw it was like one way, it was like a whole community of people that cared about HBCUs, not only their school, but also their conference and across that line. And I just felt like it was a little bit, the way that the information was gotten out there wasn't up to date and up to speed necessarily, because those entities didn't necessarily have the manpower or the access or weren't ready with the technology to, armed with the technology to, for how sports content and sports news was being consumed. And so I just said, hey, you know, still pretty young at the time. I was 26 going on 27. You know, I had been, you know, doing social media, you know, since social media had been around. And so I just kind of figured I would, you know, use my reporting skills being in North Carolina and then using my experience with social media to mitigate the things that I didn't have. And so, you know, just kind of went out and started going to games and writing about things that were going on nationally as well. And then, you know, a couple of years later, you know, things will grow and my partners, Tali Carr and then Wally Pitt will come along as well, adding their expertise on the video side and just taking this to a whole nother level. And so, yeah, it was really just a matter of making sure that HBCUs had the same type of coverage or as best we could that the, you know, the PWIs, predominantly white institutions, and specifically the Power Fives and the schools that you saw day in and day out on ESPN did. So that was kind of the genesis of it. And that's kind of still the North Star to this day, you know. So that, if that wasn't too long of an answer.
I mean, it needed a long answer. I mean, you can... if you gave me a short one, it would have been kind of, you know, especially for something as important as why you created the site, because I enjoy it. And I was going to say, you can tell just pulling in all the writers you have over the years, it shows in the content. I mean, today I was reading about how Florida A&M selected their new QB, the guy from Hawaii, and obviously reading about all the other topics. I mean, that article I really enjoyed. Actually, I remember the one I read earlier this week was about Tuskegee College. You were interviewing the new not you, but someone with your staff was interviewing the new AD about where they're going there and when football might be a part of that. But, you know, as that AD said, they're still building up. They're still creating all of that athletic program from scratch. I mean, it's fascinating stuff. Again, I hope those of you out there hearing me talk about it understand how much I enjoy HBCU Game Day, both the Twitter account, but especially the website where all of this reporting has been going on. You know, Steven, I just figured since – you went to Winston-Salem State. I have a couple questions I actually wanted to ask about it. Because I remember I became familiar with the university, 15, 16 years ago when I was actually working with a researcher there. And I wasn't as familiar with it. So, you know, I got curious. I looked it up, learned all about Clarence Big House Gaines. I mean, you can't learn anything about Winston-Salem State and not understand the legend that coached there in men's basketball and won the first HBCU to win an NCAA national championship at D2 in 1967. Am I right on that? I think I am. All right. So, but anyway, and Stephen A. Smith played for him. That I remember. I learned that years ago. Stephen A. Smith played for Clarence Gaines back in the day. That to me, I thought was amazing in and of itself. But what else? Yeah. What would you say if you're telling somebody what makes it exciting to be a part of your school?
I think so, and I'm sorry, I was on mute. I was agreeing. Yes, you did have right. 1967, the first HBCU to win the NCAA title. But yeah, I think you know, our school, we're kind of like, I would say amongst all HBCUs, we're kind of in the middle of the road. We're not the biggest schools, you know, the biggest HBCU, you know. There's a school down the road in Greensboro who is the largest HBCU, and they're only 30 minutes down the road, and there's a lot of them there. And I'm talking about North Carolina A&T, which is another great school. And so, you know, and you've got your FAMUs, you've got your Jackson State, some of the bigger HBCUs as far as you know, student bodies and sports followings as well. And then you've got, you know, some of your smaller schools, private schools, divisions at the Division II level and even at Division I. And we're kind of middle of the road. You know, we've got, you know, a decent sized student body. But I think just there is an energy there that and I'm sure everybody feels this way about their HBCUs. But I noticed about Winston-Salem State is just really, from the time I walked onto campus back in 2004, you know, it just felt like home. You know, we call each other Ramily and things like that. And it's for real. Like, you know, last week I had the privilege of participating in an event that goes on for the freshmen at Winston-Salem State. It's called Ramdition. And so it's basically a freshman orientation week where they bring the freshmen in a week early and they go, you know, they give them all this instruction and all the stuff that, you know, they tell them all these things that they're not going to live by and forget as soon as they walk out. Well, you know, at times in their college careers. But at the end of it, there's a pinning. It's called Lambs to Rams. And so they ask the alumni to come back and volunteer. And so what happens is all of the young ladies receive a necklace with WSSU on it. And then the young men receive a red tie. And then they go through this ceremony through our archways. And then they are no longer Lambs. They are officially Rams. And I got a chance to do that last week as an alumnus to connect with the class of 2026, which is crazy because, you know, I remember when I came in 2004 and I was like, man, the class of 2008 seems so long away. So I got, it gave a chance to reconnect, you know, with the, you know, the past myself, with the future, which is them. And so I think just things like that are what make all HBCUs in general, but especially Winston-Salem State, really intimate. And it's something that, you know, we're passionate about. And sometimes, you know, the administration feels the brunt of that passion. When we don't, when we love something, we love it. And when we hate something, we hate it. But you're always going to hear about us because we're very passionate about our university. So I go to a lot of great HBCUs and a lot of great traditions, but I would not want to be anything else other than a Ram.
That's awesome. And that tradition is really neat, I got to say. You know, and on the football field, I remember that was actually one of the interesting stories last year was that they threw a tag off of Robert May. Is it Massey? I forgot. Is Massey?
Massey.
But, right, yeah, Massey. But after two seasons as interim coach, I don't think I'd ever seen that before where a guy served two full seasons as an interim head coach before they decided to move one way or the other. Why do you think that happened?
Yeah, well, you know that. Yeah, I think I turned it the longest interim job ever. And, you know, to go back in 2019, you know, there was a parting of ways with the previous head coach. You know, he was let go. And, you know, Coach Massey stepped in as the head coach of the program. And, you know, he was a defensive coordinator at the time. And, you know, he stayed at his defensive coordinator salary while the legal battle was going on. And, you know, as with a lot of HBCUs, you know, the financial resources and implications are way heavily into decisions. And, you know, Coach Massey kept his salary for, I guess it was 2 years, his coordinator salary while they were, you know, figuring out what they were going to have to do court wise. And, you know, Winston-Salem State doesn't have the money to pay. I guess they didn't feel like they had the money to pay to be paying two head coaches potentially. So he carried the water for the program in 2019, 2020. There was no CIAA football. And in 2021, again, as the money issues were being worked out, you know, he, you know, again, served as the head coach. And, you know, it was two rough seasons, back to back losing seasons. And prior to the 2019 season, WSSU had gone, I believe they had gone 10 years without a losing record, which was the longest point in HBCU at that point. And so, you know, folks obviously want to win. They're not happy about the losses. And, you know, it's definitely been it was definitely a point of contention. But, you know, I think at this point, you know, hey, they've made their decision where, you know, who's going to be. The interim tag has moved off. They're going to sell it that they're trying to now that the interim tag is being moved off, they're going to have more flexibility and, you know, more reach. We shall see. But the proof's going to be in the pudding. They start off at the season this year in Canton, Ohio, at the Hall of Fame game against Central State, which is another HBCU with a proud tradition. NAIA champs twice with Billy Joe back in the 90s. And they've had a downturn as well. So, you know, now it's time for folks to put up or shut up. You know, we don't have any more, the interim tag's off. And so everybody's, you know, you are what your record is at this point.
You know, I know it's funny you mentioned that. I know, for example, at NAIA, Tennessee State, I think they had won at least one hoops championship when they were in that. I remember back when I toured NAIA headquarters, it's in Kansas City now, but they moved around a bunch. But I remember they still had the ball and all that stuff from when Tennessee State became, and that was a big deal because I think it was also part of it. The NAIA would let HBCUs into the tournament at a time when that wasn't, I think, as available.
Right.
And I believe it predated Winston-Salem State winning the NCAA D2 title in 67, but
So they won back in the late 50s. They won the NAIA title. So a lot of times, you know, folks will say that Winston-Salem State is the first HBCU to win a national championship. And I always make sure I correct them on that because, yes, Tennessee State did win the NAIA title 3 years in a row under the legendary coach John McClendon, who really taught Big House Gaines a lot, who was also you know, instrumental in HBCU basketball and HBCU sports in general when he was at North Carolina Central and then also at Tennessee State. So, yeah, but you're right. The NAIA was the first national body to open up to HBCUs, you know, back in the 50s when they started to do it football and basketball, because I believe Tennessee State competed in Tennessee State and possibly Grambling competed in the NAIA in football as well. So yeah, the NAIA was definitely the first to open the door for HBCUs, and obviously the teams at Tennessee State were amazing. I think they were just inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame, the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame, which is amazing. And yeah, it's just an amazing legacy of HBCUs, how, you know, matriculated and the doors being closed, which forced us to, you know, make ways and to build our own traditions, which a lot of which carry on to this day. So just amazing the history and the interconnectedness of HBCUs. And that's one thing that we try to, you know, always make sure that we do, you know, no matter, you know, whether teams switch conferences or go to different divisions. There's always that interconnectivity there on some level, especially if you dig back far enough in history. So, yeah, shout out to Tennessee State for everything that they've done and what they're going to be doing going forward.
Well, I know we've been talking an awful lot about Winston-Salem State now Tennessee State, but I think part of the interest also and what I think more fans, especially general fans, are familiar with are the teams at the FBS level. So I wanted to ask just a couple questions there. And also we will get this to anyone who wants to guest call. I see you, Thack. I know you were on last night. We'd love to have you back. Would just be patient for a sec. And then anyone else, if you want to talk, just hit a request and we'll try to get to as many callers as we can towards the end. But what I wanted to ask, you know, there's been a lot of moves at the FCS level. I think, and we've talked about them again, the big guy down the street from Winston-Salem State, NC A&T, there, North Carolina A&T, they were the first to kind of start this, at least in my mind, moving to the Big South and now moving to the Colonial Athletic. Where, and Hampton too, I should say, are we going to see a crisis for at least one of the two traditional conferences for HBCUs? I think the SWAC seems to be healthy, but are we going to see some stress with this move for some teams out of the traditional HBCU conferences?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, if you look at it, obviously Tennessee State has been in the Ohio Valley Conference for, you know, 35 years or so. You know, so they've kind of always been an outlier, and then everybody else on the Division I level was MEAC or SWAC. And, you know, you talk about the movement of the MEAC again, you know, I go back to my alma mater, Winston-Salem State, back in 2010, decided to go back to Division II and rejoin the CIAA. They just weren't ready to make the move up to Division I, because had that move happened, the MEAC at that point would have planning on going to a 12-team league. Football-wise, would have been two divisions, would have helped on travel costs and things like that, and possibly got a championship game. And things might have really been different, but I think that was a situation where that's kind of a microcosm of what's kind of been one of the things that has made it particularly difficult for the MEAC, in that there are a lot of HBCUs on the East Coast. There are a lot of them that are just not ready. They're just not Division I programs. And they have, you know, in the CIAA country as well as the SIC. And so they have, you know, the programs can kind of be far, few and far between. I mean, if you look at the MEAC, right, before A&T left, it was only North Carolina Central and North Carolina A&T in the conference as MEAC teams. That was their only in-state game, right? If you Division II level, where you have the CIAA, there's seven schools, right? So that helps you keep your costs down, right? That also, you know, that it just, it's more cost effective. And, you know, if you're a bigger school, you know, you may be able to absorb the cost. Again, North Carolina A&T is the biggest HBCU and has been for, you know, the last half decade or so. North Carolina Central isn't quite as big, isn't up there with that. So, you know, it's definitely, you know, but there's so many schools that are in between that. If you look at schools like Fayetteville State, Virginia State University, even Bowie State as well, that are in the footprint of the MEAC, you know, and maybe they could you know, but they don't, they have not decided to make the jump to Division One for cost and for a host of reasons, mainly cost. And because of that, it makes it tougher on the teams that are Division One, because you have to, you know, when you're keeping it, especially specifically to HBCUs, you're having to go further between, right? I mean, you know, you've got a cluster of schools in Maryland, but they're having to go, you know, previously they were having to go to Florida. They were having to go to Georgia when Savannah State was there. And so that was really kind of a microcosm of what's part of what's been going on with the MEAC. You know, Savannah State, again, they languished in Division One purgatory for about 11 years before they joined the MEAC, became a MEAC member, but eventually they decided that they would go back to Division Two, and now they're in the SIAC as well. So that's another program that left even before those that you were mentioning, because the Division One just wasn't for them, right? Then you get to Hampton, and Hampton was a situation where, you know, they came up and they really started the ball rolling for the MEAC in the 90s as far as expansion, because they came along and then Norfolk State came along on their heels. And then a decade later, you had North Carolina Central and Winston-Salem State attempt to come up. And of course, North Carolina Central is still there. So, you know, when they decided to go to the Big South, you know, they're leaving the MEAC not for because they can't afford to be Division One, but they saw something. They decided that they wanted to go to another FCS conference. And that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. That really got a lot of people upset. Some of the most vocal people were North Carolina A&T fans, supporters, what have you. And lo and behold, you know, 2 years later, they decided to make the same move. You know, they touted that they were looking to make the, they were, you know, though, again, when we were talking about the cost of being Division One and not enough HBCUs being Division One, they talked about the travel costs. And so that's how they kind of tried to sell them moving to the Big South. So you had that, then you had North Carolina A&T as well. And then you have FAMU and Bethune-Cookman as well, deciding that, you know, after years of being in the middle and, you know, going up north, taking long trips up north, they decided they would rather take them out west. So all of those have created an atmosphere where the MEAC has lost a lot of teams in a short amount of time. And, you know, that can make it tough because you're, you know, obviously the teams that are still there want to be there, and to truth be told, the programs that aren't there, a lot of people still want them to be there as well. But it is a situation where, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the schools are individuals. And so, you know, there's been a little bit of a splintering, and everybody does have to look out for themselves, right? I mean, everybody has to, you know, at the end of the day, you know, they are going to have to give an account to whoever their stakeholders are for their individual institution. And so I think, you know, for the schools that are there, it's important that they at least all have a backup or a plan B, because Delaware State and Howard have, you know, at least flirted with other leagues. And at this point, there's a 6-team conference for football, 8-team for basketball. And so it's I think everybody just has to be smart and be prudent and have a plan B, which leads to, you know, which can lead to a lot of uneasiness. And so obviously earlier this year, the CAA was heavily on Howard's trail. And, you know, we reported that they were close to preparing to make that move. And for whatever reason, you know, they decided that, you know, they would stick with the MEAC. And, you know, the reasoning that, you know, we've heard is because they didn't want to be the team that collapsed the MEAC and really put the nail in the coffin for the league. And so, you know, I think, you know, when you have a situation where the schools can look at themselves and say, hey, you know what, we really feel it. The more that they can have schools feel that they are a part of something bigger than themselves, and that they are willing to, you know, maybe make some small sacrifices in the short term to keep something together that they all believe in, I think that's definitely helpful for them. Commissioner Sonya Seals has, you know, been there Not quite a year, actually. She just officially started in January. So she's been working feverishly to try to figure out, you know, how to make everybody more comfortable. I think it really is just a matter of making everybody more comfortable, getting everybody feeling confident that things are growing. You know, there's always the push for expansion and the desire for expansion. And I know that, you know, the schools in the CIAA, some of them that I mentioned, Virginia State's and things like that, they have been reached out to. At this point, they are, you know, members of the CIAA, and they're longstanding members of the CIAA. And Division One, you know, again, it's making that move up to Division I is a huge move. And again, with the transformation committee and all the things that are going on, I think a lot of people are waiting to see if it's going to be any easier. And then that entrance fee, that entrance fee doesn't necessarily help as well. So, and you got to keep it going. So there are a lot of things that go on. You know, people always want to play matchmaker and say, well, this team needs to leave this league so this league can thrive and survive. But every individual school is looking at their own situation, what their costs are, and, you know, the risk reward that I think a lot of people online don't necessarily have the proper, you know, vision of what it is. So,
you know, it's fascinating to hear all of this, especially what we're seeing even at the, you know, you could say this, the two super conference league, that we're seeing that money is making people break longtime traditions, obviously with USC and UCLA bolting from the Pac-12, which they've been basically more or less the initial members since the predecessor was created. But money talks.
Right.
And it's interesting that I really was intrigued by how you phrased it about Howard, which of course makes sense. I mean, Howard is very prestigious academically. It is, you know, it is the Washington, I mean, there's more than one in Washington, but, you know, it's in Washington. It's a premier HBCU. And the idea that they would be the one to kill a conference, I could see how that would rest heavily on their shoulders. But at the same time, you know, to me, it's an interesting juxtaposition, because I remember when Savannah State tried and failed and decided to move down to D2. And I remember that kind of half-baked abortive attempt that Florida A&M had trying to be an FBS school. And I don't think a lot of people even noticed they tried that before returning back. So those were kind of the moves that I'd remembered watching HBCUs do. And then suddenly there's like a different trend with Hampton, with what's going on with North Carolina A&T, and this idea that suddenly HBCUs are actually trying to get more of the pie, you know, rather than sitting with the status quo. Now, whether there's a benefit to that or not, I don't know. There's a lot of, as you really thoroughly went through a lot of those questions, you know, I think part of it, the impetus, at least somewhat, has been how schools view the Celebration Bowl as a topic kind of related to all of this. Where do you think the Celebration sits right now? I mean, is it, especially with what's going on with MEAC, is that something that could shake the very foundation of that? And has it been good for HBCU football?
You know, it's interesting. So again, having been around since pre-Celebration Bowl era, I do remember when it was initially announced. I know that on the MEAC side in general, and I'm talking about the fan perception specifically more than anything, and to a certain extent, institution-wise, it was met with a lukewarm reaction at best. You know, they were, you know, again, the SWAC had, you know, decided back in the 90s that they were kind of through with the FCS playoffs and decided to do their own thing. And we got an article about that and their decision to do that back in 1999. But the MEAC, they had, you know, had some wins, had a little bit more success than the SWAC in the place historically. You know, Florida A&M won the first FCS Division I AA championship back in the 70s. It actually wasn't a MEAC member at that point. It actually was an independent school, because it was actually in the SIC before it transitioned over to D1 fully, which is another fascinating story. But so they had some wins in the late 90s. South Carolina State had some wins in the 80s. North Carolina A&T as well had some wins. And so they had prided themselves on being competitive in the larger FCS community. And, you know, I would say that in my experience and in my observations, you know, I think there's a little bit different of a mentality. I don't want to be blanket, but I think there's been historically a little different of a mentality in the East Coast HBCUs, the CIAA and the MEAC versus the SWAC and the SIC. And I think, you know, like so many things that we deal with athletically come from historical context, and it comes from, you know, dealing with the history of racism. And on the East Coast, the further you go up, it's a little bit more veiled. It's a little bit more less resistance in your face. It's more of kind of like of a passive thing. And so I think that, you know, they felt like, and I think in the Deep South, there is more of the, hey, no, this is where the lines are, and we're not even going to dance around it. Like, this is where the lines are. And I think that leads to a different philosophy on everything in a lot of ways, in just in intricate things. So I think the SWAC had already decided that they weren't going to be the larger FCS culture wasn't going to welcome them, or they weren't going to be able to succeed in the structure the way that it was built. And so they decided they wanted to build their own infrastructure. And I think in the MEAC and on the East Coast, there was that urge to, you know, there was that urge to maybe, hey, there's a little veil of, hey, you know what? You know, you guys can compete with us. And I think a lot of people liked that. A lot of people liked being able to go beyond just being the best in HBCUs. They wanted to shoot for that FCS. And I'm not saying that, you know, everybody wants to win as big as they can, but I think it was a little bit, I think it took the MEAC a little bit longer to acquiesce to the idea that, okay, you know what? We're not necessarily going to send our best to the greater championship, you know, the greater pool. We're going to send it and something that's going to be HBCU specific. And I think there was a little bit of resistance to that initially, but I think, you know, once the Celebration Bowl came out and folks got a chance to go, I've been blessed to go to all of them. I think folks started to understand the significance of the Celebration Bowl platform that it brings and the opportunity that it brings. And I think they have definitely embraced that more on the MEAC side than they previously had. And of course, you still have some folks who feel like ultimately they're doing the schools a disservice not to be competing within the greater FCS competition. But I think, you know, in general, I think it's become something that, you know, a lot of people are proud of. I would say more so now than when the idea was first put out there. And so, you know, it does provide the visibility that HBCUs often don't get to see or haven't often gotten to see, you know, as far as a nationally televised game on ESPN, I'm sorry, on ABC. And so that provides a level of prestige and a bowl experience that I think that everybody that has, every program that has gone through it has enjoyed it. And I think it's building as a destination, an event, and a big thing in the HBCU community and beyond. So obviously the eyeballs of the nation were on it, particularly this year with Coach Prime and his team being up there in South Carolina State, a school that, you know, was being threatened with being shut down not, you know, half a decade ago with some things that were going on within the state of South Carolina. We're talking about shutting it down or putting it off. You know, they got a chance to show up on a national stage. They got a chance to, you know, play the spoiler and to really put themselves on the map to an audience that maybe had never seen a South Carolina State game. And I know Coach Buddy Pugh, who's the longest running coach in the MEAC and in HBCU football, and I'm guessing he's probably one of the longest running now in FCS, who's been there for 20 years. You know, he talked about even he didn't really understand the scope of what the celebration of the eyeballs that the Celebration Bowl gets, the prestige that gets, and how, you know, it's altering. And, you know, the thing about it, you know, you're talking about the MEAC and the playoffs and everything like that. And, you know, every year what would happen was, you know, you would get to, you know, you'd have all this energy about HBCU's football from the start of the season, the MEAC SWAC Challenge and all the classics. And then you go through homecoming season and then everybody has their respective championship races. And then, you know, the SWAC will have their championship game early December and the SWAC champion wins the SWAC championship, which is great. But, you know, that's kind of the end of it for them. And then for the MEAC, you know, the MEAC champion gets to go out and say that they're the MEAC champion or a lot of times co-champion. And the last year that they didn't go to Celebration Bowl, hell, almost everybody won a championship. I'm kidding. It was five champions.
I remember that year. That was so popular.
Yeah. It was like watching a car wreck, you know, and nobody dies, but like everybody gets bumped up.
Like the AC Coastal. You know, I just want to take a second to do a quick station ID, so to speak. You're listening to RCFB Talk 64. We've got Stephen J. Gaither. He's the founder of HBCU Game Day, the premier HBCU site for a lot of interesting insight on all aspects of it, but especially football and basketball. So we do recommend that. You know, also we want to let up a couple of people. Anyone, if you want to have a comment, question, whatever, hit request, we'll get to you. In fact, now Zach, you've been super patient. I'm going to just add you as a speaker. I'd love to hear your thoughts because this is such a broad topic. I mean, when I was planning this, I'm like, my goodness, I could just pick one topic. I mean, we just started talking about Winston-Salem State, and I know I could have easily filled an hour talking with you just about Winston-Salem State. But I mean, it's fun. I love it. So, but Zach, you've been patient. What's up? What did you want to ask?
Oh, yeah. Hey, Steven. Hey, thanks for coming on, man. This has been super insightful. I'm a white dude, and I'm from Missouri, man. We only got two historically black colleges up here. Mm-hmm. They're both small, Lincoln and Harris Stowe. Mm-hmm. But, man, I love all things football. And I got a chance last year to catch a couple of the HBCU games. And, man, it was a good time. My thing I wanted to ask, though, if you could touch on this a little bit, that would be crazy. The bands. I mean, the bands are insane. I had a buddy who went to a historically black college, and he was showing me videos of the band. And I read somewhere online, actually, that Louisiana State, they pretty much more or less stole Neck, the song Neck, that tradition from historically black college. But the bands are just insane, man. They play with like the most like ridiculous passion, and it's loud, and it's like it's unlike anything I've ever heard of before. And I know this is not necessarily football, but man, that was something that just totally stood out to me when I was watching those games. My buddy was showing those videos. I don't know if you have any insight into that. I know I kind of got off topic, but man, that was wild.
Well, you can't not mention the bands. I mean, I was actually wondering how long it was going to be until someone mentioned the band, only because I think for a lot of folks, growing up, that would be their initial familiarity with it. But Steven, I want to talk over you. Sorry, but I was like, oh, wow, we're getting a band question immediately. But
yeah, no, it definitely is a thing all its own, it's interesting. Now, again, having done this for 10 years now, there's so many pockets of HBCU-dom. And the band heads have their own special, they're their own special cult within HBCU sports and culture. So, man, you know, football fans, you know, they might go at each other's necks, you know, about their football programs. But look, the one guy you don't want to get into argument with is a band head, because it can get real ugly real quick. You know, we all love our bands, and everybody loves their individual bands. And but obviously, no two bands are alike. Although some like to sound like others, I'm not going to throw any names out there because I don't want any of that smoke. But you know, I heard one of my friends say that a certain band or two bands sounded like cat sex. And you know, it was So that's the type of thing that the type of commentary that you can get from the band heads. And so it's really, again, its own culture, its own genre. I know a couple years ago, shout out to my guy, Gerald Huggins. He did a story where he, you talk about Neck. So Neck is actually, the foundation of Neck is from a song called of Cameo, the group, funk group Cameo, which most people know Candy or Word Up.
Yeah, man, great band.
Yeah, yeah. So in 1984, they dropped a song called Talking Out the Side of Your Neck, which is really actually a social commentary about politics and era, which is that's actually what it's about. And so, but it has a bass line that's amazing, and just like most Cameo songs do. And so, you know, the song comes out, and again, at this time, there's no Twitter, there's no YouTube, there's, you know, very little HBCU football is even on TV, but obviously bands had been a thing way before this. So this song comes out, and you know, obviously everybody, again, in different parts of the country are hearing it at different times. And so, you know, but again, people who have an ear for band and are band heads or band directors, they hear it and they just say, hey, this is a song that we should play. So, you know, we did a story again, you know, about how that song became what it was or what it is. Again, this is a song that's now 30, almost 40 years old, and it's still being played every week. The bass line from it, and it's the modified version of it, is being played every week. And so, you know, depending on where you're from and where you heard it first and how old you are will determine on who played it first. Some people on the East Coast will tell you that it was Norfolk State University, Spartan Legion. Out West in the SWAC, you know, they'll tell you that it was Texas Southern, the Marching Storm. And so it's just great banter. Who was actually first? You know, I think somebody pulled out a video, you know, but I you know, who knows? But it's like a urban legend, and it's fun to talk about it. At one point for a while, it was one of our most read stories. So, you know, the bands are something that's inescapable. I mean, you can't get away from it. It's one of the things that make HBCU football the brand that it is. And I know a lot of times folks who play the football and who are fans of the football sometimes are a little bit agitated or hesitant or reluctant to focus so much of the time and energy on the bands itself. But I think, again, it is something that makes the brand of HBCU football different. It does add its own flavor, and something that's definitely not going away anytime. So it's something that draws people in, and you hope that it draws them in so that they can come to the game so that they can support the institutions and do it. But now that we have YouTube and everybody can see it, it's a whole different animal as well. So the bands are always there, loud and proud.
Yeah, hey, thanks, man. I appreciate the insight. This was fascinating for me, man. I was able to catch, I said, a couple games last year, man, and my buddy introduced me to sort of this world. He went, I can't remember. I think Brown, maybe. Does that make sense? No. I can't remember. Morehouse. He went to Morehouse.
That's right.
And he introduced me, man, and it's been really cool, man, because I love watching all types of football and all different little worlds of football, and it's sorry to get you off track about the band stuff, man, but I had to ask. I appreciate it, man. Have a good one.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us. And by the way, again, if any of you want to chime in, just hit request. We'll try and get to you. But, Steven, you know, it's interesting to me, and I don't know if you've seen this trend, but we've seen two programs in the next two seasons, two FBS programs. Now, I went to the University of Southern California, and it up until this year, there were only three schools left in FBS that had never, ever played an FCS program. And it was USC, and coincidentally, its two main rivals, UCLA and Notre Dame. And now, this year, UCLA is hosting Alabama State, and that's going to break their streak, in addition to being the first HBCU host. But I think it's much bigger than that. This is their first time they've ever played someone who isn't an FBS team. And then next season, Notre Dame's going to host Tennessee State. And again, that's going to be the first FCS program, let alone HBCU, that Notre Dame has ever hosted. So it seems to be a trend towards, you know, HBCUs kind of becoming a part, not only of the college football culture, they always have been, but becoming high profile teams that are worth, you know, making what almost seismic shifts to what programs have been doing before. Am I wrong in thinking that, or is that something you've noticed trending up?
Yeah, well, I think it's a number of things. You know, a couple of years back, you know, I think back to, 2013, 2014, where Ohio State played Florida A&M. And I believe, you know, obviously they played FCS schools before, but that was the first HBCU they played. And they paid them a handsome sum for that game. They got all their money's worth in the points section back. But, you know, so that's, you know, there have been teams, that's always been there. And again, I mean, when we talk about the bands, you know, again, a lot of people, you know, don't like to steer into that conversation, but it is something that they have that other programs, specifically FCS programs, don't have. And I think it is really interesting that you're seeing programs, like you say, that have never played FCS schools before, seeing them playing in HBCU, because, you know, in HBCU at this point, folks know that, you know, that comes along with, you know, the band, with the culture. And that also gives them a chance to engage some of these predominantly white institutions or larger institutions. It gives them a chance to engage their Black, you know, alumni base. This week, I'm going to be in Atlanta, but we're going to have several members of our crew over in down the road in Chapel Hill, you know, where they're going to be playing Florida A&M. It's a big event for the Black alumni there, where they get to, you know, they get to come back and they're going to do a lot of events and programming around it. And so I think, you know, when you're looking at UCLA, you're also seeing more, you know, when you're looking at diversity and Black and inclusion and Black and brown faces in athletic administration at these schools, and they have a voice. I believe the one of the folks at UCLA in administration, and I don't want to say it's the AD, but someone that's high up, he had a connection. He's from North Carolina. He had a connection to North Carolina Central, who's also going to be playing UCLA next year. And so, you know, they were able to work that out. And then obviously Notre Dame scheduling a Tennessee State program that has a storied history as well. And it doesn't hurt that they have Eddie George, former Heisman Trophy winner. And they're a brand that is ascending and rising back and trying to get back to becoming one of the premier HBCUs and FCS schools. And they have, I think, you know, it's definitely been a greater awareness. There have been a lot of things that have come down the pipeline in terms of business, because business is really what this is too, as much as anything else, that have come down the line for HBCUs that, you know, a decade ago, we wouldn't have seen. 5 years ago, we wouldn't have seen. And so I think, you know, every HBCU needs to, you know, be prudent in making sure that they seek out those opportunities, capitalize on them when they make sense for them, and really use them to build their brand. I mean, you know, for Alabama State or North Carolina Central to go out to the West Coast, you know, not only is that a chance for them to go out and get a check and get a guaranteed game, and also get their players an experience of playing in, you know, in those type of fields and arenas, but it's also a chance for them to get to a part of the country where there are no HBCUs. There are HBCU alumni, though, and what you'll see is there's so many people that will come to a game like that, you know, whatever people will travel with the team, but also the folks that are the Black alumni of the particular school. And then also maybe just HBCU supporters who may have gone to, you know, they may have gone to Grambling or they may have gone to Southern, and they don't get a chance to really see or feel that HBCU vibe. And they'll get a chance, and they're out on the West Coast, they can, you know, if they're in LA, they can go and support Alabama State and get a little bit of that as well. So I think everybody, you know, HBCUs are hot now. You know, HBCUs are more, the mainstream is more willing to embrace them and to be tied to them, because they are such a symbol of Black progress and, you know, what Black folks have meant to this country. So I think it's pretty cool that they're getting a chance to do that, getting some good guarantees, which, you know, pretty much all FCS and D2 schools do play guaranteed games anyway. And so I think it's just a great opportunity for them on the business side, for sure.
You know, I have to, speaking of, you know, the ascendancy of HBCU football, I would be remiss if I didn't ask your thoughts on the impact Deion Sanders has had on the entire culture and the business, every level of it.
Yeah, well, look, he's certainly been good for my pockets, you know. I'm not going to sit here and lie to you. You know what I mean? It's, you know, Deion Sanders, you know, and we've had pro football, we've had pro HBCUs for years. I mean, you know, it's usually guys who are alumni of those programs or alumni of HBCUs that decide they want to get into coaching, and this is how they've done that. You know, Ken Riley, who should be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, who got one step closer recently in Canton. You know, after he finished his standout career with the Cincinnati Bengals, he went back to Florida A&M, his alma mater, and did some great things there. And then there's been guys like Billy Joe, who went to Villanova back in the 60s and turned into powerhouse programs at Central State and FAMU. There has been Pete Richardson, who, you know, played in the NFL in the 70s and then got his start in college at Winston-Salem State University, led them to a couple of championships, and then went over to Southern and really cemented his legacy as well. So, you know, we've always had pro athletes, former pro athletes as head football coaches. But obviously, Deion Sanders is one of them. You know, you can count that stint that he had with the Ravens back in 2005. You know, it's been 15 years. It's been, you know, over 15 years since he's played. A lot of the guys that he's recruiting now never saw him play. They never saw prime time. They just know the guy from the TV show. They know the guy who's on social media, the guy who is connected to everybody, and the guy that, you know, is not afraid to, who has never been afraid of promoting himself. And now he's not afraid to promote the young men coming into his program. And so, you know, he has definitely just been, it's been a game changer, no doubt. I mean, you know, he brings in a set of eyeballs that I don't think anybody else in football culture really could have brought in to Jackson State, for sure, but also to the SWAC and to HBCUs at large. And so, you know, it's definitely been one of those things, like, you know, we didn't necessarily see coming. You know, 2 years ago, he started talking about the HBCU Combine, and it was like, okay, that's cool. Deion's, you know, doing something for the HBCUs. That's cool. And then he, you know, in that August, he came out as a graduate of Talladega College, who we were talking about earlier, who doesn't even have a football program, but he, you know, immersed himself there because he didn't get his degree at Florida State. And so, and then lo and behold, he becomes a head coach at Jackson State. And so it's been a seismic shift, and he has, it's really energized everything. They've given HBCUs a team that you either love or hate for a lot of people. And I don't think, and not just the traditional people that you hate them because they beat your team. Like some people just hate them because they're getting more attention than their team. You know, they are, yeah. And then some people who maybe necessarily didn't care about HBCU football before have definitely decided that, you know, this is something that they want to do. There's been a proliferation of, you know, folks who, you know, are now covering the SWAC or commentating the SWAC or HBCU football. You know, there, that's been that outgrowth as well. There's just been a whole seismic shift that he has caused, you know, that he's had success last season. We'll see what happens this year. But, you know, him just being who he is, having the connections that he has, and just always being out there and consistently being out there has definitely been a game changer. And it's one thing that I don't think anybody had on the chessboard. And I think you would ask even himself 5 years ago, but it's been just a major bit of light to come to the HBCU spectrum for sure.
Do you think the success, or at least a splash, I mean, the splash is almost as big as the success on the field, and you could argue they're the same thing. Do you think that's part of what led Eddie George and Hugh Jackson to also now join the HBCU coaching ranks? Because I think both of those were like, wow, Eddie George is now going to be at Tennessee State. Hugh Jackson, wow, Hugh Jackson's going to be coaching Grambling. Is that to stent the Dion effect?
I would say a little bit. You know, if you listen to Eddie George's introductory press conference back in the spring of 2021, you know, he talked about how he never saw himself as a coach. And, you know, Coach Prime, Deion Sanders, you know, he's been coaching at some level since he's had kids, right? He's been coaching Shador and Shiloh and even Deion Jr. He's been coaching his kids for years. He's had the, you know, the Prime prep and then went over to Trinity as well, coaching there. So him being a coach was something that we could have probably foreseen happening, but Eddie George didn't see himself becoming a coach 6 months before he became the head coach of, you know, one of the HBCUs and FCS programs with one of the best traditions ever. So I think there's a little bit of that, but I think it's just a matter of more so of HBCU administrators being willing to go outside of the box with, I think we all, again, have to recognize there's only one Deion Sanders, right? And so not everybody's going to be able to come in and get you that type of publicity, that type of support. You know, Eddie George didn't have Diddy on the BET Awards, you know, yelling about he was going to, you know, promote his program, you know. So Deion Sanders is one of one. But I think, you know, it provides another option for HBCUs. I think, you know, HBCUs have always had great coaches, coaches that cared about the young men that they were entrusted to them, about building them. And obviously this goes back not only to Jake Gaither and Eddie Robinson and those guys, but also, you know, back to, you know, Coach Hill over at Morgan State, who, you know, went 54 games without a loss, and so many great coaches that have gone through the HBCU spectrum throughout the years. They've been great coaches. They've been great doing recruiting with what they had, turning a little into a lot. But, you know, the resources have always been the thing that HBCUs have lacked. So, you know, now it looks like more HBCUs are going to a CEO type of head coach approach. We also have, you know, I think one interesting one we're going to see this week, which is Eddie Robinson, who is an HBCU alumnus. He is head coach at Alabama State, which is his alma mater, but he's never coached before either. He's kind of in that same boat as well, but he's been a successful businessman. He's made connections. And now, you know, he's coming in to run his alma mater's football program and see if he can't get them to the next level. And so I think, you know, his hiring maybe made some administrators look at how they're hiring coaches in a different way than just, you know, hiring, you know. I think they're realizing that the resources have to be there, and they need, and maybe they feel like they need a coach who can help them get resources just as much as they need a coach that can help them help do X's and O's. So,
Stephen, I know we've been on for an hour. I just want to say, if you can stay, I'm happy to keep asking questions, but I know you're busy. I know you've worked. If you want to stay on, we'd love to keep talking to you.
Oh, I'm good. Yeah, go ahead. Fire away.
Awesome. Yeah, I know. And by the way, Trey, I see you. I'm going to go ahead and add you as a speaker, and we'll get you in a second. But, you know, I'm glad you brought up Alabama State, because I was wanting to ask about Eddie Robinson, because that was an interesting coaching situation as well. I mean, they're in the MEAC SWAC Challenge, as I recall, to open the season, aren't they?
Yep.
That's been a little bit uneven, hasn't it? I mean, the SWAC has got the has a lot to prove. Despite, you know, the issues with MEAC stability, the SWAC, I mean, it seems like they've had, they, I mean, it's stacked. I don't know the exact record, but it's stacked towards the MEAC at this point, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe it's 11-4, 11-4, 12-4.
Yeah, that sounds right, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, definitely the MEAC has had the upper hand on that, as well as the Celebration Bowl. You know, I did, you know, I did talk to a coach who was coached, who's coached in both leagues, asking him why that success has been there for the MEAC games in particular, because if you take away those games and you talk about just in-season showdowns, it's a lot closer. Even last year's champion, MEAC SWAC winner, North Carolina Central, they were able to beat an Alcorn State team at the beginning of the year, but then they lost to a Mississippi Valley program that has struggled heavily in the same year. So it's, you know, it's definitely one of those things. And I, one of the things that he told me, that this coach told me, that usually, and he's coaching both leagues, he told me that usually SWAC is more of an offensive league, the MEAC more of a defensive league. And usually in the first week of the season, defenses are ahead of offenses, right, for most schools. And so that was one reason he felt the MEAC had success in that first game. And then obviously there is the MEAC champ usually has about a month off prior to SWAC champion. So, you know, there is that. I mean, teams have overcome it. You know, Grambling was able to beat North Carolina Central in the 2-1 Celebration Bowl where our guy threw his helmet off. But that's been, that was the exception and not the rule. And so I think, you know, for the SWAC, they have a proud history. You know, they're in the same footprint as the SEC. And for, you know, people who aren't, you know, familiar with HBC football, they're in pretty much the same footprint as the SEC now, literally. Well, they don't have Oklahoma, but, you know, from so from Florida to Texas, they're there. And they, you know, so they care about their, they're passionate about their football programs. And, you know, I would, you know, they're not going to like this, but I would say that they're the more passionate fan base. They talk about football 20, they're plugged in on football 24/7. I don't care if it's like SWAC championship basketball night or afternoon, they're still talking about, you know, in March, they're talking about who's going to win what game in football. So they are a proud, they have a proud history and tradition, and, you know, it, it definitely means a lot to them. I know they hate that they are, they have become this, but until, but, you know, they're going to have to will off some wins in these games, because what do people remember every year? They remember the first and the last game of the season, how you started and how you finished. And they've been starting and finishing by, you know, taking L's. So it's going to be interesting just talking about this. You know, Eddie Robinson has never been a head coach. Obviously, his coaches that are his assistants have. So, but Howard and Coach Larry Scott, who, you know, was a guy who coached at the Power Five level, was an interim head coach at Howard. I'm sorry, at Florida for a second, you know, and has come to Howard to try to build that program up. He has the task of preparing for a coach who has never coached a game. And so, you know, you kind of have to see how things are going to shake out. So, yeah, the, it's been a, it's definitely been tilted to the MEAC. And I think it's going to be interesting for sure to see how it works out this Saturday. But I will be in Atlanta along with the team, and I'm excited to figure out, see how this works out.
Absolutely. Hey, Trey, you've been really patient. What did you want to ask?
Hey, first of all, Steven, I want to say thank you. This has been a very interesting topic, and I've enjoyed it. I've first learned about a lot of HBCUs when Coach Nolan Richardson in basketball for the University of Arkansas scheduled a bunch of HBCUs, and I got to see a lot of games growing up against Grambling, Jackson State, Delaware State, I think Bethune-Cookman. You know, it's really interesting to see it. But I'll get on to my main question. Hopefully, it's not too much of an oddball question. In the Northeast, there's another league that doesn't play a bowl and has its own kind of like ecosystem. Mm-hmm. I don't see a lot of MEAC or SWAC teams play. Have any HBCUs played an Ivy League school? And has there ever been any discussion about some of those games being played or anything like that? So, well, anyway, Steven, thanks.
Yeah. No, thanks for the question, Trey. I really appreciate it. Yes, they have Howard Sutter at Harvard a couple years ago.
Yeah, that was a big deal.
Yeah, it was a big deal, and they're going to play again this year as well. Howard is definitely hoping that this one goes a little bit better, because that was the year where they decided that they were going to hire Ron Prince. And that was that. And turned out to be a disastrous year. He only lasted a couple games before you know, some things came out about accusations about what he was accused of. That's the story that we broke. And, you know, shortly thereafter, the investigation was open and he was shown the door. And so, you know, that was a, and I'm pulling up the, Harvard put up 60 on Howard. Yeah, not the way that you wanted to do that. But so there is that game for sure. And they're going to play again this year. They're going to play in D.C. It was 62-17 was the score. Not really a red letter date, but, you know, hey, there's a new year this year. And so, yeah, you have seen that. And I wouldn't be surprised if you saw more of that. Again, the new commissioner for the MEAC, Messiah Stills, you know, she likes to refer to the MEAC, which has rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, some people the wrong way, but a lot of people really like it. And that is the Elite Eight. And so when she says the Elite Eight, she's talking about the institutions more so than the football particular program. And so, you know, and really trying to push the MEAC forward as a league of, you know, excellent academics as well as athletics. And so I wouldn't be surprised going forward, especially with the MEAC right now being, you know, contracted and only having six programs. There's a lot of space on there for a lot of different things scheduling, which I think is one good thing or one interesting thing that's come out of the MEAC having all these changes. And so, yeah, I definitely could see opening a door where there's some type of a challenge or, you know, just a scheduling, maybe not necessarily a scheduling alliance, but, you know, definitely where they say, hey, let's see how we can work together on both our brands and come together and collaborate on some things. So so they have played Ivy League.
I just want to mention, Stephen, that also Howard is not only playing Harvard. The week before, they're playing Yale.
Yeah. So
they're at Yale, and then they host Harvard. So that's going to be really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And Howard is definitely one that I would say is probably the most likely to do so. You know, for those who aren't familiar with HBCUs, Howard, you know, is in D.C. It's funded by the federal government, I believe. And so it has some advantages, and it's, you know, always been it's one of those schools that is heavy in academics. They don't have a lot of on-field success football program-wise.
The one thing I think you can give them is they had the biggest upset, I think, in terms of any casino that was willing to even put a line on it. When they upset UNLV several years ago, that was the biggest upset in the history of football, I think, when they looked at the spread.
Yeah, it was. And so I think, you know, and that's a great point. It was such a huge deal. You know, Kalen Newton, Cam Newton's younger brother's first game. Definitely a point where, you know, I think Howard definitely got into the minds of a lot of people, but I just wanted to paint the picture that they have been the school that is academics, 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 and when they don't win, they can say they're an academic school, and they've always hung their hat on academics, and so playing Ivy League teams fits right with the profile of what they want to be and what they want to do, and so obviously they like to be more competitive, obviously they like to win, and so you see the two games they have this year. And they also, I think their scheduling this year, they might have had like one of the highest GPA schedules ever, because they also play Morehouse and Hampton, as well as Yale and Harvard. And so they're playing some pretty smart teams, you know, academics wise and everything like that as well. So, yeah, I think you'll definitely see Howard continue to do that. Again, given the scheduling flexibility where, you know, you only have five conference games. So now you can, you know, you can play an FBS school. Then you can play a couple FCS schools. And then if there's a D2 program that's close to you that makes sense and you want to kind of, you know, after you've recouped your money and you want to kind of beat up on somebody else, you can give them a little bit of that money and do that. It kind of backfired against Howard last year in a game against VUL. But, you know, it's definitely an Ivy League and MEAC challenge. I think in a lot of ways makes a lot of sense. So maybe we'll see that someday.
I'd love to see that. That would be great. Hey, thanks for that question, Trey. Jake, you're up here. We'd love to hear you.
Perfect. Well, yeah, thank you guys for setting this up. And Stephen, thank you for doing this. You guys do great work, and I'm a big fan. Now, this might be a bit of a touchy subject or a controversial question, so I apologize in advance. But going back to Dion for a second, I've always just sort of been curious, is there any thought that Dion's, I don't know if he still is, but affiliation with Barstool or anything like that sort of hurts what he's trying to do or maybe rubs some people the wrong way?
Yeah, I think it's something that initially when he came in, I think a lot of people were, especially, you know, a lot of Black folks for sure, were leery of with Barstool's reputation and the things that they've done, you know, and the things they've got called to the carpet on, rightfully so, in a lot of cases, in most cases. But I think, you know, it's a business deal for him. And he sees, you know, he has seen the value in it for him. But it does. But I think on my vantage point from where I sit, I look at what he's done with his internal media, our partners, the pregame show, you know, where he gives them scoops. Like they were the first ones to have that Zimmer was going to be an analyst and help Deion Sanders out. He gives them a lot of exclusives. He also makes it a point to talk to Black media as well. And I think, you know, Black folks have always, to get ahead, we've always had to have some alliances with some folks that, you know, maybe kind of made us a little bit shaky and a little bit, you know. And so I think that, you know, it's something that's easy to compartmentalize. And I don't think it's been quite the spectacle that a lot of people thought it was going to be initially coming in. So obviously, you know, he had his reality show, and I haven't seen, I don't know what's going on with that at this point, but I mean, the bar definitely made folks definitely squirm, kind of uncomfortable a little bit. But I think at the end of the day, that what he's doing to put the spotlight on JSU and HBCUs as a whole definitely outweighs any feelings that folks have about Barstool, especially since they've kind of, that partnership hasn't been as prominent in a lot of ways as we thought it might be.
You know, we've got so many folks who've been now wanting to chime in, so I want to get them. Doc, you're next. We'd love to hear from you.
How everybody doing? I'm Doc Holliday with HBCU Overdrive with Doc Holliday. It's a daily YouTube show that I do. Just started up like a couple months ago in May. But Steven, I put in on Twitter, and I put in a thing saying that if Howard can at least put like 40% of their interest into the athletics as they do with academics, I don't see how they would be. I don't see why they won't be able to compete. They'd be able to compete for like the VAC championship, or, you know, to get to the Celebration Bowl. What do you feel about some, like, that's what I said, kind of like what I said, like, do you think that, is it true, or do you think they need to invest a little bit more?
Well, I'm sure. Well, thanks for the question. I'm sure that, you know, Coach Scott would love to have some more resources there for him. You know, I think Howard in football is an interesting proposition. They're never going to make a ton of money off of it because their stadium is so small. You know, they sit about 7,000 or 8,000. So they're never going to make a lot of money for football, at least, you know, generating revenue on that end. But, you know, and, you know, truth be told, even when people talk about HBCUs and HBCU football, internally, you know, in HBCUs, we know what their history is and, you know, the shortcomings that they've had, but they're always in the conversation. And for me, it seems like for them, the main thing is just to make sure that they're topic of conversation. So, you know, it would be great. They did have some competitive teams in the 80s and 90s. I think it's always there for them. I think it's just a matter of if they see the value in winning the MEAC title. I think now with the Celebration Bowl, and that's kind of where I was going with the Celebration Bowl question earlier. Now there is, with the Celebration Bowl, gives you a end of the year, something to spike the ball. The scoring a touchdown is winning the MEAC title. But, you know, when you got a chance to win the MEAC and your reward, the playoff game on the road with only a handful of fans, and you're probably going to lose, it's not quite as sexy as, you know, getting to go to a bowl game against another HBCU in a big city and giving your athletes that experience and extending your brand. And so, you know, I think for Howard, now, if they're ever going to do it, I would think that now would be the time that they're going to do it. While the MEAC is small, you know, I think while the MEAC is small and while there is a, you know, maybe a window open for them. So, you know, I think it's just going to matter to, you know, how the president feels about it. And of course, they're about to have a presidential change, you know, pretty soon. Dr. Wayne K. Frederick is leaving out. Athletic Director Kerry Davis is still there. And he's trying to do a lot of creative things. But it's going to be interesting to see what the new president is and what their philosophy is and how much value they put into putting the dollars into sports. Because as we saw last year, they have some major infrastructure issues that they have as well. You know, people are always talking about the money that Howard gets and complaining about that, but they have a lot that they have to fill, you know, figuratively and literally. So it's something that, you know, would be great if they could do it, but, you know, we'll see what happens.
And also, I got one more question. Who do you feel is on the hot seat all around HBCU football, or just within between the MEAC and the SWAC?
Good question.
I don't know. So much has changed. So many people are in year one or two, you know. I mean, I would – some people have said Delaware State coach Milstead, but I don't know that – firing Coach Milstead would be the answer, even if things didn't go well this season. I think Delaware State has some issues. They got to have some come to Jesus meetings about what they're going to do with their football program anyway, as far as getting it out of the cellar in the MEAC. And, you know, we have so many new coaches. I don't know that there is necessarily a hot seat at this point. You know, some people might say Bethune-Cookman. You know, Coach Sims has been there for a while, had some success early in the MEAC. Things have kind of leveled off, but again, the institution has had a lot of turmoil. We'll see what Reggie Theus wants to do. Obviously, he's a basketball guy, but he is also the AD. We see he moved the football game. He made the move that Coach Prime wasn't necessarily a fan of, moving the football game to Jacksonville. We'll see what his expectations are of Coach Sims. I think if they have another really bad season, it's going to be hard for him to keep his job. So he might have the hottest seat between him and the Texas Southern coach. But again, Texas Southern, again, is a program that, you know, a lot of this stuff is like you can change the coach, but a lot of this stuff is if your infrastructure is consistently bad and you've gone through all these coaches and you've never won or you haven't been winning, you know, how much is a coaching change going to really impact things? So that's kind of where I see it.
Well, I was about to say Doc Gamble for UAPB because I feel like when they play Alcorn, and they had the lead, and they gave it away. I feel like that was the downfall for UAPB football at the time. And we talked about him coming off being SWAC West champs in the spring. But I feel like he's on a hot seat also.
Yeah, their AD seat has been a hot potato seat. So, I mean, again, they could fire him. And, you know, it might make some people happy. But should they? I don't know. It's probably deeper than that. But we'll see. It's going to be interesting.
Doc Holliday, thank you so much for joining us. Steven, you got some time? We got a couple more people up here who I think would love to ask you some questions.
Sure. I can take a couple more questions.
All right. Sounds good. Colby Brown Sr., you've been really patient. What's up?
What's going on, Steven, man? I am Coach Brown over here at Central State University. You know, I coached in the MEAC for some time at South Carolina State last season. Mm-hmm. You know, just knowing the importance of MEAC football and, you know, SWAC football for the HBCU culture. And now I'm at another HBCU, you know, Division II Central State University. And, you know, our first game is on NFL Network versus your school, you know, Winston-Salem State. I just want to know, you know, what do you think about this game and, you know, the importance of this game for the D2 HBCU? And, you know, are you all going to be there to cover it? You know, how do you see this game shifting the Division II HBCU spotlight? You know, I know it's a lot of talk about the MEAC and the SWAC, you know, FAMU, South Carolina State, Jackson State. But how do you see Division II HBCUs this season? And, you know, what do you think about this first game being on NFL Network and the importance of, you know, Division II HBCU football as well?
Yeah, great question, Kobe. I appreciate it. Yeah, I think it's definitely important that, you know, when I started this, it was HBCU game day, and my belief and my history, you know, having gone to Winston-Salem State, especially mm-hmm. when I did, and I'm sorry, Siri, I'm not talking to you, but I, you know, going to Winston-Salem State when I did, I was able to see WSSU as a Division II school and then trying to make the transition to Division I. And so I wasn't necessarily locked into being just a conference guy. A lot of people kind of goes into that, like, I'm a MEAC guy, I'm a SWAC guy, I'm this, I'm that. For me, I think I see value in all of the HBCUs, and I think it's important that we cover it. A lot of people are upset now because so much of our Jackson State dominates so much of our coverage when, you know, in fact, if you look at what we're doing versus what a lot of people that are in the space of HBCUs are doing, we're covering Livingstone, we're covering Johnson C. Smith, we're covering some of these Division II schools that you know, even school, even folks who are have HBCU channels totally ignore. And I understand why they do that, but I think it's also important that, you know, these are some of the oldest HBCUs that we have are in Division II, some of the HBCU football programs that are the oldest. We just did a story. Everybody check it out. The amazing Tom Skip Foreman, who just retired from the AP after 43 years. And he said his retirement goal was to come work for us at HBCU Game Day, which is just blew my mind. He had a great story about Livingstone College's new blue turf. And about, you know, really what they're trying to do under head coach Sean Gilbert. You know, they played the first HBCU football game 130 years ago against Johnson C. Smith. And, you know, being a Winston-Salem State guy, I got to give all of those teams, you know, some ribbon. So, you know, I did say that that was the only time that Johnson C. Smith's program was over 500 as a program when they won that game. But that's neither here nor there. You know, D2 HBCUs matter just as much. And I'm glad that those two schools are in the Hall of Fame game, because both of those schools have made contribution. Both of those schools have competed on the national level. Both of them have been to the D2 national championship game. Central State was back in the 80s, and then, of course, Winston-Salem State back in 2012. And I think it's going to be a great game. Two programs that are looking to get back into the spotlight, have fan bases that are very proud and like to win, love to win, crave winning, but they haven't had a lot of it lately. So I'm really excited about it. I will be there in person. I've never been to the Hall of Fame, so it'll be a great chance to go check out the Hall of Fame. And I'm looking forward to the competition between the CIAA and the SIC, because on the low, the CIAA has definitely been, the CIAA in particular, has probably been the most successful HBCU conference football-wise in competing nationally over the last decade or so, when they've had not only Winston-Salem State make their run, but also had Virginia State win playoff games, and then you've also had Bowie State as of late become a national power as well. And so I see, you know, schools like Tuskegee, Morehouse, even though they've been down for quite a while, you know, and you look at a program like Edward Waters and Allen, and the excitement that they have around those programs as well. A lot of great things are going on in Division II football. And I'm glad that the Hall of Fame decided to give them a spotlight to shine along with SCS schools.
Great. One more question, man. You know, for me being an HBCU coach for these past couple of years, you know, I definitely see the, you know, the hype and just, it's just a great experience, man. And the times have changed. And I know you've been around covering HBCU football for a while. And, you know, like I said, just being a part of the culture, it's just been amazing. You know, you can feel it. It's just a great feeling, you know, but as far as this season, do you think this is the most hype season, and will this be to you, the most watched season for HBCU football, like the most important season this season? Do you think?
I definitely think it has the capability of being it. When you talk about the new deals that the SWAC and the CIAA have announced with HBCU Go Byron Allen's platform. You know, we did a story a couple of weeks ago how an update to last year, where last year there were more HBCU games than ever that were you're able to view without actually having to go into the game on TV, streaming, and everything like that. This year, the number is even bigger. So the stage just continues to grow larger. A lot of us have said that maybe the best thing for HBCU football was for Jackson State to have the year that it had, get the spotlight that it had, but then lose in that championship game, because it opened up the eyes to the amount of talent that are at HBCUs. Today, the Senior Bowl watch list came out, and there were 14 players from HBCUs, which were almost half of the number of guys that were from the FCS and Division II ranks were HBCU talent. It's been proven that we have talent. What we haven't had is the infrastructure to really build up program sustainability. And so I'm hoping that with these new TV deals, with the new energy around HBCU football, that will continue to go and grow for years to come. So I think at all levels, we're set up for a great year. And, you know, I honestly can't wait to get started and get out there on the field.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it, man. I will see you out there September 4th. I'm going to come up to you, introduce myself, you know, so I'll see you out there, man. I appreciate it.
No doubt. Good luck to your squad. We'll see you in camp.
Yes, sir.
Thanks. Yeah, you know, I just remember you mentioned Bowie State. I know they lost their head coach to Morgan State just this past offseason. So that, I wonder how that'll affect them, but I guess we'll see there. You know, we have one last guest, kind of respect your time. He's already up here. Herbert L. Seward III. We'd love to hear from you.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, I'm a contributor for Saturday Blitz on the Fansided platform, as well as HBCU Digital Network. I know HBCU athletics, basketball, football for the SWAC, MEAC, and pretty much all our other conferences. Just want to give a big shout out to Steve, man. Steve's a real pioneer in our space. You know, a lot of us that are on here, Doc Holliday, BJ Jones, and a number of folks that are, you know, on the space now. You know, Steve has really kind of laid the groundwork for a lot of us that are contributors and content creators. Steve, I do one question for you, man. And this is an actual prediction for this coming weekend for Alabama State and Howard University. How do you see the game going?
Hey, first off, thanks for the kind words, man. I really appreciate it. I appreciate all the work that you do and the passion behind it and everything like that. But, man, you know you set me up. You know, y'all give me the ask. You get me out here. You know I'm going to go to the game. You know I'm going to be in these players' faces. And it's going to get back to somebody. But, you know, it is what it is. It's all good. You know, I'm not unlike my guy Stephen A., my fellow Ram. You know what I mean? I'm actually in their faces and everything like that. But nah, it's all love. It's all good. I think both coaches have their challenges. I think Alabama State, you know, they have to contend with the Howard program that, you know, has started to really get some gel and have some fire under head coach Larry Scott that I think they have wanted to see in that program for a while. They've been together for a while. They have a dangerous quarterback. I mean, I'm not the biggest X and O's guy, but I know that guy can play. And the kids in that program, have been through a lot. I talked to them at Media Day. They still have a lot of those guys who are on that 2019 team that I talked about, which unfortunately for them turned into a dumpster fire of a season. But they've gone through and they persevered through that. And I think they're really hardened and toughened. I like to give Howard a hard time because, you know, just because I like to give Howard a hard time. But now their program is really on its way up. And then Alabama State, you know, you got new head coach Eddie Robinson, who's never coached a game before, which can be a gift and a curse because, you know, we don't necessarily know how he's going to call the game. You know, we all obviously know as coordinators, and you can kind of see what they've done at other places. They got a new quarterback, Demetrius Davis, who formerly was at Auburn. And so I think it's a lot of energy on both sides. I think these are two programs that are hungry for wins. You know, last year you had Alcorn State, who, you know, they had been the SWAC champions for the previous 2 years. And not to say that they weren't hungry, but you know what I mean? It was a little bit different, but I think you got two programs that are hungry for success that feel like they're probably not that far away from being competitive and they want to make a statement on a national stage. The MEAC has had this one. I'm going to give the slight edge to Howard just because, you know, they've had a little bit more continuity and I like the quarterback Quentin Williams, but I think it's going to, hopefully we're in for a great game, a nail biter, and myself and the guys that will be down there, my guy Big Cove, as well as Simone Stanley, we're really excited about everything that's going to be going on this weekend in Atlanta. And hopefully we'll get the Honeybees and the Stingettes. And ooh la la.
Yeah, as an Alabama State product, man, you'll definitely see the Honeybees and the Mighty Marching Hornets. There's one thing I just wanted to add on to the Howard discussion in terms of their program. Being a DMV guy that follows prep football in the area, the one thing that a lot of people put at Howard is being able to tap into that talent pipeline that's there in terms of football, particularly at the prep level. And I think Howard has a real difficulty in doing so because of the admissions and the grades requirements that, you know, kids have going to school there. You know, that may be changing soon. Not necessarily admission standards, but a focus in the area to really kind of, you know, get in on the ground level for, you know, that talent that's in the area. So it's going to be interesting to see what Scott and his staff does. There are some people on that staff that recruit the area really well. So, you know, we're looking forward to seeing what happens with that. But as far as the game goes, yeah, as Alabama State guy, you know, it's hard for me to pull against my Hornets, so I'm not. So it's going to be Alabama State.
Well, thanks so much for contributions. This has been a great – and I just wanted to add, in addition to some great writers that have been in the audience, like BJ Jones, I also wanted to add Chris Ferguson. I saw you in the audience, too. I wanted to give you a shout-out. I enjoy your writings on D2 a lot as well.
Winston-Salem State, Ram. I'm sorry.
So, Steven, you know, thank you. This has been a great talk. And I wish we could go on longer, but I respect your time. I can actually feel you kind of like been on here for like an hour and a half.
I had to be more it's all good. HBCUs, you know, it has in its last decade, it has become, you know, something that impacted me, you know, 18 years ago when I entered Winston-Salem State. It impacts me to this day, who I am as a person and as a man. And it's become, you know, my not only my life's work, but my passion. So I could talk about this stuff all night. And toughest stretch for the year, like a lot of folks for me, is like once basketball season is over, and that from April to August kind of drags on to me. So I'm just really excited to be back, catch some HBCU football. Looking forward to going to some places I've never been before. Like I said, I'm starting the season in Canton. May make my way down to Baton Rouge to see LSU Southern. You never know where you'll catch me. Last year I did end up at Bluefield State, one of the new HBCU programs. You know, you may catch me at Itabena, Mississippi, where I went last year, which was a treat. And you know, I like to pop up at the big games, but also, you know, get some of those different atmospheres and vantage points. And those are the type of stories that we're looking to tell just as much as the bigger ones this year. So I'm really excited about it.
Absolutely. And I got to say, I enjoyed your Bluefield State article because that was an absolutely fascinating one. The demographic shift at an HBCU that's now like 90% Caucasian because it's in West Virginia. And, you know, watching, you were there for homecoming. And it's a great article. I recommend it. I'll drop it in the for sure.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It was amazing. You know, Coach Coaxum there, he has a great story. You know, he's a guy, he went to Army. He ended up coaching, you know, in that Super Bowl where the Denver Broncos stole it from my Carolina Panthers. You know, we won't go into that. But nah, he's a great guy starting up that program. And there was a twinkle in a lot of folks' eyes, you know, who hadn't seen their school represented on the football field in so long. And they were just excited. So I'm excited to see the growth of that program as we go forward this year and maybe make another trip up the mountain. We'll see.
Absolutely. Well, again, thank you, Stephen. Thank you to all of you who contributed. It was great to hear from you. I know it started with a lot of questions for me because I love asking questions. It's why I enjoy this. And gosh, it's such an interesting topic with so many areas to touch on. So if you haven't checked out Game Day, check it out. Twitter account and the website especially. We can't recommend it enough. Thank all of you. We hopefully will be able to have Steven. If you're ever up for it, we'd love to have you again. So this will be real fun later in the season.
Anytime. I'm looking forward to it. You know, the grind is here.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much, everybody. We hope you have a great night. And on the hang up and listen.